recording, and leave that off. And recording. Very good.
Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi, Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam Sarvabhutakuhashayam Yat Sarva Vishayatitam Asmai Sarva Vide Namaha.
Home, very good. Welcome to you all as we continue our study of Shankara's Upadesha Sahasri, and of course welcome to the many students who are watching this, I should say attending this class remotely. We have maybe 20, 30 students here. There are more than 1,000 watching regularly online, so that's very gratifying to know that these teachings are reaching out like that. We begin a new chapter today of Upadesha Sahasri, and that's why I made a special invitation that this is a good time to join or rejoin, because the organization of this text is, I can only say, unique for several reasons. First of all, every chapter is a completely independent lesson. It's like a style of publishing is to publish collected essays of an author. So this structure seems to be the same here. But what I find a little more odd about this particular text is the way the chapters are organized. If you leave off the first chapter, the remaining chapters are organized from shortest to longest. Huh? You might say that's completely arbitrary. Well, this is a collection of independent lessons. There's no continuity from chapter to chapter. Now, there's a consequence to that. So far, the chapters we've been seeing have been fairly short, 10, 20, 30 verses. The chapter 15 we just finished was some 54 verses. Now the chapters get longer. So this current chapter 16 is 74 verses, the next is 89. Chapter 18 is 233 verses long. Now, if you say, well, why are these chapters suddenly getting so long? Turns out that Shankara's approach in these later chapters is to introduce much more scholarly material. If a few of you think already this text is so scholarly, he adds that much more scholarly material to the latter portions of the latter chapters. And when I say adding scholarly materials, generally what's done is to introduce opposing points of view based on other schools of thought, based on the teachings of the Shunyavada and Vijnanavada Buddhists, based on the dualistic teachings of Sankhya and Yoga, based on the highly logical teachings of Nyaya and Vaisheshika. So starting with this chapter, we have a lot of that material included. Let me just check this, no problem. Okay. A lot of that material is included, and it leads to a bit of a problem for our class, and that is, if you haven't already studied Nyaya and Vaisheshika teachings, what Shankara presents won't be meaningful or useful for you. So it's meant for scholars, basically. So what I've done in the past and what I will now be doing from this chapter forward is to go through the chapters in advance and find those highly scholarly portions and remove them. And it turns out when that's done correctly, the result is surprisingly good. If any of you have done editing, you know the more you remove from whatever you're writing, the better it gets. It's very counterintuitive. And I find that somewhat true in these chapters as well. By removing the highly scholarly content, what remains is even more brilliant, in my opinion. So that is our strategy going forward. In chapter 16 we're starting, there were a number of lengthy refutations of Shunyavada, Vijnanavada, Vaisheshika Mata, etc. So all of those have been removed. And what remains, about half remains, roughly half remains, and that's what we'll be seeing today. The very first topic of the chapter is actually a refutation of Charvaka Mata. Now, if you don't know what, again, if you don't know what is Charvaka Mata, if that's not familiar to you, you can see my point that it's helpful to remove that material. Simply put, Charvaka Mata is materialism, you know, like modern science, and in particular, Shankara refutes the view that the body is Atma. And when I started editing this chapter, I said, we don't need a chapter on the body is Atma. After all, this is a more advanced class. So that, starting right from the beginning, the first topic has been removed. Let me get the slides up. Slide is up here. Let's get the slide up here. There. So the very first topic is dealing with the body, and that gives rise to the title of the chapter. Most of the chapters, as we've seen, are based, the chapter names are mostly based on the first word of the first verse, which is, again, completely arbitrary, but again, this is a collection of essays, so to speak. So the very first word of the very first verse is Partiva. Partiva means that which comes from Prithivi, earth, and earth represents all five elements, so that which is made of elements, starting with your body. So that's the first topic. And as I said, I've chosen to remove that first topic, so even though the title of the chapter is Partivi, that won't be part of our discussion. In fact, that topic only goes on for four verses, and then the rest of the chapter has nothing to do with Prithivi, just to illustrate the arbitrary nature of these titles. Okay, before we plunge in, I'll mention that these slides are available in a PDF on our website. Some students like to print them out and take notes. I print them out and scribble all the things I want to talk about in this class. And as always, I'll be making references to the main commentary on this work by one Ramakrishna about 500 years ago. Very nice commentary, so it helps to resolve any doubts or issues that I may have as a translator. Okay, so with that introduction, we can begin. Having skipped the first four verses, which are concerned with the refutation of the idea that your body is Atma, then we move on to really, if there is a central topic that is a thread going from chapter to chapter, that topic would have to be Atma Vichara, self-inquiry. Of course, That's really true of any and all Vedanta texts, but it is especially true of this text. Again and again, we see Shankara's brilliant approach from one side, from another side, different angles, different ways of inquiring into the nature of Atma, the true self. And you'll see that continues right here. Okay, we'll begin, and as always, as I'm reciting, read the translation, and then repeat after me. Vyanjakasya yatha loko, vyanjakasya yatha loko, vyangyasya karatam gata, vyangasya karatam yata, yatikirno pyasankirnas, yatikirno pyasankirnas, tadvadnya pratyayai sara, tadvadnyai pratyaya sara. Yatha alokaha. Yatha, just as aloka, light. What does that light do? That light is vyanjakaha, that which reveals. Light reveals. Light reveals objects. How? Like this light is revealing the object sitting in this chair. It is an object, right? This is an object sitting in this chair, revealed by that light. What about that object? Vyangyasya akaratam gataha. This is our Vedantic analysis. Actually, Vedantic analysis applied to physical phenomenon. Shankara is very almost scientific here. He says that this light reveals the object sitting in his chair, how akaratam gataha, by going here means assuming the form, akara, assuming the form of vyangyasya, that which is being revealed. Sounds complicated, it's not. Light reveals the object sitting in this chair by assuming its form. This will surprise you if you haven't thought about it. And that is, you don't see objects. You see light reflected by objects. Think about it. You're not seeing an object sitting in this chair. You're seeing the light reflected by this object that happens to strike your eyes. That's how sight works. So you're not seeing the object at all. You're seeing the light reflected by this object. And it seems like you see the object because, as Shankara says very clearly, light assumes the form of the object. That's it. So Shankara had a very scientific perspective in his verse. Of course, elsewhere it's not so ancient. We've seen many, many times that the ancient worldview is often quite different from the modern scientific worldview. But this is an example of where they're in lockstep. Shankara says you don't really see the object. You see light reflected by the object. You see light in the form of the object. The point he's leading up to, by the way, this is the drishtanta in the first three lines of the verse. Drishtanta is a metaphor. So we're not studying physics here, right? Did you ever take a class, physics of light? That's a common undergraduate class in many colleges. That's not our purpose here. So this is given as a metaphor, and then the application of that metaphor to Atma follows. And that's what the last line will steer us towards. So the last part of this metaphor is perhaps the most interesting. And that is vyatikirnaha api. The vyatikirna means combined. There seems to be a combination of light and object. And what I mean by that is, what you see is a bright object. Right? You see a bright, you don't see me in dark shadows. You see me in bright colors. So how that seems ordinary, but look at Shankara's observation here. Vikirnaha api, even though there seems to be this combination between brightness and object, so you have a bright object, he says, even then, asankirnaha, they're really two separate things. The object sitting here in this chair is one thing, and light is completely different. Notice in the expression bright object, we've combined two things which are actually quite separate. And that turns out, of course, there's no consequence at all in the example, in the metaphor, but now let's apply it to Atma and you'll see the consequences. So having seen the drishtanta, the metaphor, now we see the darshtanta, that which the metaphor represents. By the way, in English, we don't have a word for darshtanta. Right? A single word that very specifically describes what a metaphor represents. We don't have a good single word for darshtanta in English. So what do? My teacher used to make a joke. He says, the best you can do is darshtanta. You're going to say it with an American accent. Okay. So, in the Darshtanta, Shankara says, Tadvat, in the same way, Jnaha, the knower, consciousness, Pratyayaihi Sada, continually has a relationship with objects. So, Shankara is very terse here. It's up to us now to apply the Darshtanta to Atma. First of all, he says, light reveals the object, just like consciousness reveals mental objects. This is where we begin. In your mind are mental objects, we call them vrittis. Three major categories of vrittis would be thoughts, cognitions, would be emotions, and perception. So right now, in your mind, is an image of me. So that image of me in your mind is an example of a perception. So the object outside in the chair is illumined by this light. The mental object, the vritti, the image of me in your mind is illumined by consciousness. A very standard metaphor that we use in Vedanta again and again. And a couple of classes ago I reminded you, remember it's only a metaphor. There's no light shining inside your head. It's as though illumined. Metaphor. And he says, just as this light reveals this form by it, this light reveals this external object by assuming its form, in the same way, the light of consciousness reveals the image of the Swami in your mind by assuming the form of the Swami in your mind. That's how it works. Thoughts arise in consciousness. Thoughts, when you say a thought is illumined by consciousness, it means consciousness is reflected by that object in your mind, having taken the form of the Swami. So again, you're not seeing the object in this chair. You're only seeing reflected light. In the same way, when you experience a Swami in your mind, what you're experiencing is reflected consciousness. Consciousness reflected by that vritti, reflected by that image of the Swami in your mind. And by the way, this technical term, reflected consciousness, simply means experience. That's all it means. What are you experiencing right now? Consciousness reflected by the Swami image in your mind. Compare that to conventional thought. In conventional language, I see the Swami. In two levels, you're wrong. First level, you don't see the object, you're seeing light reflected by the object, so you're wrong at the level of physics, and then you're wrong at the level of metaphysics, if we can use that term here, which is how you perceive that mental object in your mind. Now, the last part, which is, this so far is a very standard teaching of Advaita Vedanta. In the third line, Shankara puts a little spin on it, which is really the point of this verse. What he says is that there appears to be sankirnata, combination. The object in this chair seems bright, leading us to fail to discern the difference between the object and the light. There are actually two things here. There's an object in the chair, and there's light illumining it. In the same way, there's an object in your mind, the Swami image, vritti, illumined by consciousness, and you take it as a Swami, you take it as Swami appearing in your mind. That makes the error of combining consciousness and the object in your thought, which are two different things. Shankara concludes they are asankirna, they're absolutely separate, leading to this very profound and important Vedantic teaching, that is, consciousness is utterly separate from the objects it reveals in your mind. In the next verse, we're going to see the, or do we see it here? Just want to see where that we discuss that. Okay, we'll discuss this later, but let me make a point right here. The significance of this observation, that the consciousness that illumines the objects in your mind is asankirna, uninvolved, untouched. We often use the word asanga. It's a very typical word to use in this context. The importance of that fact, taught by Shankara here, can't be overstated, because asankirna means this light is utterly unaffected by what it shines upon. Whether it shines on me or it shines on the dirty floor. The floor is not dirty, by the way. No, it's perfectly clean. So, I need the metaphor. It doesn't make any difference to the light. The light remains untainted by the dirt of the floor, and the light is not particularly benefited by shining on this object sitting in this chair. The light remains unaffected. Now, apply that metaphor. The implication, very clearly, is your consciousness, the consciousness that reveals the experience you're having right now, that consciousness is utterly unaffected by whatever it reveals in your mind. This is such a crucial teaching of Advaita Vedanta, because it shows that even when sadness and agitation are present in your mind, consciousness doesn't become sad or agitated. When the light shines on this orange cloth, does it become orange? If there's agitation here, does the light become agitated? You get my point. The consciousness, which is the essence of who you are, remains utterly unaffected by whatever is happening in your mind. Such an important teaching. And before we go on, just to make an observation. The observation is this. Many people think of Advaita Vedanta as a philosophy, and that is absolutely incorrect. philosophical matters are abstract, conceptual. We're not dealing with something abstract and conceptual here. Is your sadness and agitation conceptual? It's a felt experience and an experience that causes suffering. So for this reason, I think it's important to note right here that Advaita Vedanta is not a philosophy. It's a solution to the problem of suffering. That's really an important distinction. Okay, let us continue.
Stito dipo yatha yatnaha. Stito dipo yatha yatnaha. Praptam sarvam prakashayet. Praptam sarvam prakashayet. Shabdad yakara buddhirgnyaha. Shabdad yakara buddhirgnyaha. Praptas tadvat prapashyati. Praptam sarvat prapashyati.
Again, drishtanta and darshtanta. Drishtanta begins, yatha, just as, dipaha, a lamp, an oil lamp in ancient times, a lamp which is stitaha, standing there on a table, just like that lamp on a table. Prakasha, you have to drop down to the second line now, prakashayet. It illumines sarvam praptam, everything that's nearby. Whatever is nearby the lamp, the lamp illumines. Something in another room is obviously not going to be illumined. So there's a matter of proximity here. One of two things Shankara wants to discuss here. So first of all, we recognize the need for proximity. So if any object near the lamp gets illumined, and we'll see the darshtanta in just a moment. To finish the drishtanta, he says that the lamp does this illumination. The word we skipped at the end of the first line is ayatnaha. Ayatnaha means without effort, without exerting any effort. Does a lamp have to really try hard? In fact, if you're further away from the lamp, does the lamp have to try harder to illumine you? The lamp doesn't. Actually, the lamp is a much weaker source of light at a distance. Remember something called the distance squared law? Anyway, that's not the name for the law, is it?
Inverse
square law, right. One over R squared. Inverse square law. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. So who cares? Sorry. I get carried away with all this ridiculous scientific stuff. Okay. So, the lamp may shine less brightly at a distance, but it still illumines you at a distance, and it does so without making any effort whatsoever. So this drishtanta shows two things. One is that the light reveals what is proximate, what is nearby. Second is that the light reveals effortlessly. Now we apply both of these things to Atma. And that's in the darshtanta, in the second half. So it says, see it in the last line, tadvat, in the same way. Go up and find the word nyaha at the end. Nyaha, the knower, meaning consciousness. The consciousness does what? Prakashayati, it illumines. Back to having that problem. So look at that. I think it's interference with the. That was turned off. I just want to check one thing. It is turned off. Okay. All right. I'll look at that later. So jnaha, consciousness, prakashati, it illumines. What does it illumine? What does it illumine? Third line, shabda adi akara buddhihi. Buddhi here means vritti, thought, mental events, so thoughts, emotions, etc. And it illumines buddhihi, mental events, vrittis, whose akara, whose form, those which take the form of shabda adi, sound, etc. For example, right now in your mind is a vritti in the form of my voice. So the vritti in the form of my voice is known how. This is another good example. You don't hear my voice. From a scientific standpoint, a physical standpoint, or a metaphysical standpoint. From the physical standpoint, my voice is vibrations of the vocal cords here. You don't feel my vibrating vocal cords unless you put your fingers right here. Then you can feel what you hear is vibrations in the air which travel from my mouth to your ear. So really speaking, sound is here. You don't get that sound. You get it remotely through the vibrations in the air. So at that level, you don't hear my voice directly. And at the inner level, too. My voice is present in your mind in the form of a vritti. That vritti is revealed by consciousness. What does that mean? The consciousness in your mind takes the form. Now here's where the light metaphor falls apart, because light is associated with a physical object. Sound is not a physical object. So here we have to just understand it's a metaphor. Just as consciousness can assume the form of an image in your mind, consciousness can assume the form of a sound in your mind. Does that make sense? That's how the metaphor works. Just as consciousness can assume the form of an image, consciousness can assume the form of a sound, and that's how experience takes place. Now, he says, tadvat in the same way, praptaha, in the same way these mental objects are prapta, we'll say experienced. Now let's apply the metaphor here. One is proximity. Only things that are nearby the light are illumined by the light. Something in another room won't be illumined. So only mental objects, there's a trick coming up here. See if you can anticipate the trick. Only those mental objects which are in the presence of consciousness get illumined. Think about it. Only those mental objects which are in the presence of consciousness get illumined. And here we've got a real common misunderstanding. First of all, there's a misunderstanding about the word unconscious as used in Western psychology. So when Freud and Jung used the word unconscious, it means something completely different from what we understand conventionally. They understood that unconscious for them is similar to memory or samskara in Sanskrit, a mental impression. So we understand very clearly whatever is in your mind is revealed. Do you think you have little things hiding out in your mind? People misinterpret this idea unconscious. They think, oh, there are things hiding in my mind. Nothing hides in your mind. Whatever is on your mind, so to speak, is revealed by consciousness. But there's lots of stuff like memories which are not currently in your mind. So what Freud and Jung meant by unconscious is more like those memories. They're not currently in your mind. They're not hiding out. So anything present in your mind automatically gets illumined by consciousness. And now I'm being intentionally facetious. See if you can get it. There are no unillumined dark corners in your mind. And I'm giving you a wrong example very deliberately to see if you can figure out why it's wrong. So every metaphor has a limitation. This lamp metaphor has a huge limitation because that lamp is in a certain position, a certain location. What is the location of consciousness? How big is it? How wide is it? Where are its edges, its boundaries? You can see how inadequate that lamp example is, but that's a commonly used example. We use it, but knowing its limitations, consciousness is utterly unlike the lamp. It doesn't have any edge or boundary. In fact, consciousness can be simultaneously present in this room, next room, and any room, anywhere, consciousness being all-pervasive, leading to the final conclusion. It is not the case that consciousness is in your mind, and maybe which could leave some dark corners. If consciousness were in your mind, perhaps there could be some dark corners, but that's untrue. Because it's not that consciousness is in your mind. Your mind is in consciousness. Whoa! Consciousness is not in your mind. Your mind is in consciousness, like space. Space fills this room. Space is in this room. True, but not as true as saying that this room exists in space. Just like this room exists in space, your mind exists in consciousness, non-separate from consciousness, pervaded by consciousness. Which means whatever occurs in your mind is simultaneously revealed by consciousness. There are no hidden dark corners. There are no unknown thoughts. And the second point he made here is ayatnaha. The lamp makes no effort to illumine things around it in the room. In the same way, consciousness makes no effort. This light makes no effort. It just shines. We saw in the previous chapter the example of the snake coming out of its hole. For the snake to be revealed by light, the snake has to make the effort to come out of the hole. Light doesn't have to make any effort. We saw that example in the last chapter. So consciousness makes no effort. Next.
Sharirendriya sanghata atmatvenagatam dhiyam nityatma jyotisham deeptam Vishyanti sukhadayaha. Sharira indriya sanghate atmatvena gatam dhiyam. I'm starting to talk now more about the problem. So far it's a fairly philosophical analysis. I said Vedanta isn't philosophy, but it uses philosophical reasoning very, very effectively. But now we shift more towards the nature of the problem. And that is, in the second line, dhyam gatam. Your mind assumes atmatvena sharira indriya sanghate. With regard to your sharira, your physical body, your indriya, your senses, which includes your mind, this sanghata, this assemblage of body, mind, and senses, all of that together, atmatvena gatam, you get
identified with it. This is one of the very, very powerful teachings of Advaita Vedanta, and that is the problem of identification. You've heard it said many times, the problem of me and mine. And this is really a huge problem. Whatever is me or mine becomes a source of suffering. You know, I've given again and again the example of a car. You go to, some of you remember my metaphors, and I tend to go back to the same ones again and again. You're going to the parking lot, you park your car there, there's an identical car parked next to yours. One has a broken taillight. And you're approaching the cars. You don't know if it's your car with a broken taillight or the other car with a broken taillight. Only when you get close enough can you discern which car is yours, which car has no broken taillight. If the car, this is interesting, if the car with a broken taillight is not yours, you feel happy. What is a German word for it? I don't know German, but there's one commonly used German expression. Schadenfreude? Schadenfreude, yes. Schadenfreude, thank you. I didn't get the pronunciation right. Which means to be happy about someone else's sadness. You're happy because it's not your car that has a broken taillight. This shows identity. Car is just a thing, right? Inside the car, where is my-ness? Now you're thinking, wait a minute, inside, I have that registration card and I've got my name on the register. Come on, the car is a bunch of metal and plastic and rubber and all these materials. Mine? This is an important Vedantic analysis. The car is an object. You feel the car is mine because you attribute to that car mineness. In Sanskrit, mamata. In Hindi, Gujarati, mamata is such a lovely word. Not in Sanskrit. So in Sanskrit, it means what it says. Mama is a pronoun, mine. Ta means ness. My-ness. You attribute to the car. Suppose you attributed to neither car my-ness. Then when you discover that it's your car with the broken taillight, who cares? You know, it just means you take it to the repair shop, you file an insurance claim, blah, 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 blah. You just go through the steps. My guru liked to say, he had a way of expressing very profound teachings with extraordinarily simple teaching words. He has said, this particular teaching, where you learn how to not superimpose minus on the car, is just a car, it's just a thing. He said, his exact words, in this way, you convert a problem into a situation. How simple. A problem is something that bothers you. A situation is something you take care of. Why should you get so upset about the car? And some people get exceedingly upset about what happens to their car. Life is too short to worry about broken taillights, right? So look how this teaching can transform your life when you realize it is not inevitable that you superimpose minus on the car. In fact, according to Advaita Vedanta, you've made a mistake. a mistake for which you pay a price, and the price is suffering. Then it goes further. Anything you superimpose minus upon becomes a source of suffering. An example I've given in many classes is when parents superimpose minus on their children, especially when the children become adults, and then the adult children don't behave exactly the way the parents expect them to. Those children, who are supposed to be a source of joy, become a source of suffering. Why? Minus. They're not your children. They're individual human beings with their own lives, their own karma, their own free will, their own desires. When you put that minus on them, not only do you create suffering for yourself, you create quite a bit of suffering for them as well. Stop it! Sorry to be a little overly dramatic here, but the fact is, like I said, life is too short to worry about broken taillights. Life is too short to get into these disputes with your children, with your spouse, with other people, in other situations. Come on, it's time to use the language. It's time to grow up in a Vedantic sense. And to grow up in a Vedantic sense is to really take these teachings to heart in the sense that they become assimilated, they become your reality. The car is just a thing. Your children are independent people. Your body is just a thing. The prana in your body is just a thing. The thoughts in your mind, just things. When you say, my body, the problems of the body become your problems. When you say it's just a thing, then this problem, in my guru's words, this problem becomes a situation. So if your car has a broken taillight, you take it to the repair shop. If this body has a broken circulatory system, heart, you take it to the doctor, take it to the hospital, get it fixed. If it can be fixed, sometimes cars can't be fixed, get a new one. That's how it works. That's exactly how it works. The point is, it doesn't have to be problem after problem after problem. It can be situation after situation after situation, which is so much easier to deal with. Okay, let's finish up this verse. So, he says that we become identified, atmatvena, sharira indriya sanghata, the body-mind-sense complex is taken as oneself, atmatvena. This is the problem of identification. Even though, and Shankara here gives two reasons that it's absurd to take something as yourself. Here he says, nitya atma jyotisha deeptam. The object is revealed by nityatma jyoti, by the eternal light of consciousness, which is to say an object is known to you due to your consciousness. I'm just going to show you the absurdity of this. Something is known to you and then it becomes mine. Your car is known to you, my car. Better yet, body is known to you, therefore the qualities of this body belong to me. I need it. Give me a black pen. I need a prop for this one. I need the right prop. Thank you. So anything known to me is me. The identification. This body, which is known to me, happens to be male. Therefore, I am male. This body, which is known to me, is aging very rapidly. Therefore, I am aging, etc., etc. You can see how the problems are going to arise now. Watch this. The body is known to me. Therefore, its age is me, belongs to me. This pen is known to me. Therefore, its blackness belongs to me. I must be black. And I'm doing this deliberately to show you how absurd this identification is. The body is known to me, but the properties of the body belong to the body, not to the knower of the body. Make sense? Same thing. The pen is known to me. Fine. The properties of the pen belong to the pen. How do the properties of the pen affect the knower of the pen? Not at all. How do the properties of the body affect the knower of the body? Not at all. So this is Shankara's first argument. And that is, anything known, whatever you identify with are objects known to you. It's absurd to identify with an object known to you, like this pen. It's an object. Why would you identify with an object? Are you an object? You're not an object. You're a conscious being. Anyway, this is the absurdity of identifying with objects. The second point he gives is that the body-mind-sense complex is Vishinshanti. It is qualified sukhadayaha by sukha, etc. Sukha, etc. qualifies this body. And it's kind of a technical term he uses here. What he's saying is that sukha, etc. Sukha means happiness. How long does happiness stay present in your mind? For a while. And then it's followed by something else. Then it's followed by something else. How often does your mood change? In a given day, your mood might change several times. That's not unusual. So, mood, emotions in general, and mood in particular, constantly changing. You, on the other hand, are the observer of these constantly changing moods. Doesn't it make sense that the observer of the constantly changing moods is itself not constantly changing? This is one of our prior teachings that we saw in several prior chapters of the Subhadesha Sahasri, and that is Atma is unchanging consciousness. In fact, if consciousness, and this is an important example, if sadness gradually entered your mind, and try to imagine this, take a moment. If sadness slowly crept into your mind, and if your consciousness simultaneously became sad, step by step by step, would you notice the sadness creeping into your mind? Do you see the metaphor I'm making? And I've given the example so many times. If you're driving down the highway at 60 miles an hour and the guy in the next car is drinking coffee, he looks completely stationary to you. But the fact is he's drinking coffee at 60 miles an hour. That's a fact. You don't see him drinking coffee at 60 miles an hour because you're moving along with him. The point of that metaphor is if your consciousness becomes sad when sadness creeps into your mind, you won't be able to detect the arrival of sadness. You won't be able to detect change. The only way you can detect change in your mind is if you are the unchanging consciousness that reveals the changing conditions of your mind. And that's Shankara's second point. And that is, the objects you get identified with are constantly changing, but reasonably speaking, you are an unchanging, conscious observer. So those changes must certainly belong to the objects and not to you. This is another example of a Vedantic teaching that has a huge payoff. When you really get it, that the sadness that arises in your mind doesn't affect you as the conscious observer of that sadness. In fact, this is Shankara's next, we won't go further today. He doesn't use sadness as an example. He uses another very common example, headache. Good to know that 1,200 years ago people had headaches just like. So we'll see that in our next class. We'll finish this class with the idea of sadness. So when you feel sad, when sadness is present in your mind, somebody sees you like this and say, "Are you okay?" And what do you say? "I am sad. Problem." Suppose, I'm not suggesting you should say this, but the fact is, sadness is present in my mind. Think about it. In fact, I'm strange enough that if you ever saw me like this, I'm not sure you will, but if they're, you know, actually possible. You know, if I lost a loved one, you don't think I would be affected? I'd be sad. So if you see me like this, because I just lost a loved one, "Swamiji, are you okay?" I would have to reply, "I'm perfectly fine, but my mind is full of grief." Fact. Problem becomes a situation. I am okay. My mind is full of grief, sadness, loss. Imagine how that teaching can transform your life when these teachings go in sufficiently. That's the goal of these teachings. Okay, a good place to conclude today. And we start next week with the headache. wait, nice way to begin. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, satoma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om tat sat.
Swamiji, I have a question. I mean,